It is 8:30, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. Good morning.
Good morning to you. You know, if I could sing a Leo Kottke guitar part, I would have helped out, but...
No, thanks. We were just having a moment of silence there for whatever ails you, so...
Yes.
Well,
mourning the loss of habeas corpus or something.
Oh, wow. Well, that... Yeah, we need a longer moment of silence than that. So... Thanks for bringing that up. Plenty to cover. Let's start with a local. The FCC is coming to town.
Yeah, they came to town in 2002 for the last time the FCC was looking at ownership rule changes to basically deregulate ownership. And that effort, led by then-chairman Michael Powell, got overturned by a federal appeals court. And so they're trying it again now. And the same thing is happening where the Republican majority is trying to ram it through. And the two Democratic commissioners out of the five are having public hearings in different parts of the country. There was actually one full commission hearing in Los Angeles. There's also been one with just the Democratic commissioners in Milwaukee, and they're coming to Seattle, and they're going to have a public hearing on whether we should have large corporations owning still more of our media. And for anybody who has any doubt about that, I have a article on Eat the State this week on what's happened at Seattle Weekly that might be of interest on that score. We flooded I believe it was a ballroom at UW in 2002. Auditorium. And it should be even bigger this year because the FCC in its wisdom has scheduled it for November 30th. Now, November 30th, some of you may remember, is the 7th anniversary of probably the most significant demonstration against our loss of our democracy due to corporate control, at least in our generation. And that happened to happen here, and many people remember that, remember the issues from that, and you can make a pretty clear linkage between that and corporate control of media, particularly, both transnationals and also, for that matter, how the WTO demonstrations were covered by media. So, if you wish to turn out, mark November 30th on your calendars. Turnout should not be a problem for this one, but if you are concerned about consolidation of corporate media in the hands of the very, very few, make sure to make your voices heard loud and clear on this one, and we'll have more on that as it gets closer.
And again, that's one of those issues that doesn't matter which side of the aisle or, you know, left, right, up, down you're on. People just are universally tend to be against it.
Yeah. If you're listening to this radio station, you know how important independent media is. So, you know, regardless of your political inclinations, this is a huge issue.
All right. So that should...
As is net neutrality. And we're seeing what's happened with that and how many people, you know, on all sides of the spectrum were opposed to the gutting of that as well.
All right. Well, this last Wednesday, the big event there at the Seattle schools, Cirque du School Board.
Yeah, the big top was raised. Three additional schools were proposed to be closed, and a bunch of parent groups and other opponents of that came into the room, and it from all accounts, got kind of out of hand. The school board wound up reversing the proposed closures and deciding only to go with the original seven school closures, which, you know, makes a certain amount of sense given the number of questions about the school closure process, the fact that the closures wouldn't have saved that much additional money, etc. But probably the bigger issue here is image. And remember that of the four progressive reform candidates who were elected to the school board in 2003, they are all up for re-election for the first time next year. And so you can see in coverage of this incident and, for that matter, the school district's more general problems by the daily papers, by the TV stations, etc., the current school board members, especially the new reform-minded folks or newer, they've been in office 3 years at this point, are just getting savaged by local media, much more so than the standing school board whose problems these folks inherited were getting savaged in 2002, 2003. So just be aware that those re-election efforts from people like Breida Butler-Wall, Sally Soriano, Irene Stewart, Darlene Flynn are going to be very, very difficult next year. And, you know, the school district has a lot of problems right now, and there are a lot of legitimate questions that can be raised, but there's also a very concerted effort underway to try and get establishment folks in and get progressives out of the school board. So, you know, be aware of that.
All right. Article this week about climate change. Here.
Yeah, a climate scientist at UW coming out with, I think, probably the first study on what climate change actually will mean to the Pacific Northwest. And surprise, you'll love this, it means more cloudy days and more rain, about 5 to 15% more in the Pacific Northwest. And if you get up the coast toward the southeast in Alaska, it'll be 20% more rain. This because there'll be more pressure over the low pressure over the Aleutian Islands. So those folks who are thinking that, gee, it's been really nice, we've had a lot of warm, dry, sunny winters recently, ain't necessarily going to play out that way, at least according to this guy. But so we can get our umbrellas and start building the seawall just that extra, you know, a few dozen feet higher.
All right. Well, jumping to national, busy week for Bush, and at least in terms of the pen and signing things.
Yeah, the Military Commissions Act, which was rammed through by Congress at the Bush administration's behest, it was early this month, maybe late last month, but he finally signed it into law Wednesday, so it is now official. Habeas corpus, after 789 years, excuse me, 791, is now officially kaput, at least in the United States, it's kaput, which, you know, we had a pretty good tradition of it here as well. Torture is now legal, and Bush now has all the, and his successors, unless it's overturned, now basically all have all the powers that a dictator would need in order to run a dictatorship, quote-unquote, legally, which reminds me of a Noam Chomsky quote that most of the great atrocities that have ever been committed in world history have been legal, at least under the legal systems of the governments that perpetrated them. He also signed into law something that didn't get nearly as much attention this week, a new national space policy. Now, that national space policy rejects future arms control agreements over the militarization of space. And in fact, although NASA has always had a significant and in recent years majority military component, this basically signs over American space policy to military use. It also codifies as official U.S. policy that the U.S. Asserts its right to, let me see if I can get the exact quote here, deny access to space to anyone hostile to U.S. interests, which of course could be anyone. And at the rate Bush is going, is going to be pretty much everyone else. So that didn't get a whole lot of attention, but that has huge ramifications, you know, 5, 10, 15 years down the road, unless, again, you know, somebody else comes in and overrides it. But, you know, these things have a way of taking on a life of their own.
Moving along, a federal judge and the Secret Service.
Yeah, Washington Post filed a lawsuit on the heels of a successful lawsuit recently to try and get the release of all the contacts by Jack Abramoff and his lobbyist associates with the White House. That lawsuit was successful, and from that we've learned out that Abramoff and his associates had well over 100 contacts with the White House, had direct links with Karl Rove, yada yada. In fact, we also got a report this week that Kenan Mailman, who is then working in the White House and is now the head of the Republican National Committee, yet another example of the Bush administration taking people who do illegal, dreadful things and then promoting them, actually got somebody, a mid-level White House staffer who is responsible for Pacific Island negotiations, fired because that person wanted to have better worker safety laws in places like the Northern Marianas Islands, which, of course, were a Abramoff client, which we knew was at the Seattle law firm of Preston Gates Ellis. Anyway, So we had that as precedent. The Post filed a lawsuit wanting to get the complete list over the last 2 years of people who have visited Dick Cheney at his office and at his residence. Cheney, of course, being the famous guy who put together a national energy policy after consulting with goodness knows who, but you can guess pretty well. That federal judge ruled this week in favor of making those records public. The Secret Service has to turn them over. So it'll be very, very interesting, and it obviously won't happen before the election, but it would be very interesting to find out who Mr. Cheney's been consorting with and whether he shot any of them as well.
All right. Film at 11.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I didn't think it was going to be a regular feature, but it's looking like you have some more entries for Sleaze of the Week.
Yeah,
awards.
In fact, I'm thinking of converting into a daily blog. It's God, once you start looking, it's just endless. There's And when, you know, you talk about culture of corruption in Washington, D.C., for some reason, all these folks are Republicans. And not that I don't think Democrats can be and are corrupt also, but that's what's going on in Washington right now. And it really is dreadful. There were several stories this week that deserve some attention. One of them, a gentleman named Lester Crawford, who is the former commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration. He's going to plead guilty to federal charges of failing to disclose owning share in companies that are regulated by the FDA. In fact, he was confirmed by the Senate in July of 2005, and he had promptly quit in September of 2005, 2 months later, because in his Senate confirmation process, he failed to disclose that he had made $115,000 in the previous year from a company that had basically was going to be regulated by the department he was overseeing. Now, he blames this on error and oversight. Personally, if I'd gotten $115,000 from a company the previous year, I'd probably remember it. He sort of claims he forgot. But, I guess that's why I haven't been nominated for anything by George Bush.
Maybe he was getting payments from somewhere else.
Yeah.
Made that seem small in comparison.
Could possibly be. Meantime, speaking of Senate confirmation, a gentleman who has been rejected twice by the Republican-controlled Senate to oversee the country's mining industry, a gentleman named Richard Sticker. Stickler was given a recess nomination by George Bush. This is the same process that they used for John Bolton and got him into the UN, where Bush waits until Congress is out of session and then he can nominate him for a year. This guy was not only rejected, he's a West Virginia coal industry executive overseeing the mining industry, and he is so bad in his managerial capacities in the coal industry, his mines have had twice the national average of worker-related injuries on the job, and he's so bad that the senators from West Virginia, both of them, who are, you know, generally considered to be in the pocket of the coal industry, both opposed his nomination. Evidence once again that George Bush not only picks foxes to regulate the hen house, which we already knew, but it's usually the most, you know, corrupt and supine of foxes that he can find. And not to leave Congress out of the cheery sleaze of the week parade, Jane Harman, the ranking Democrat on the House Intelligence Committee, on Tuesday finally leaked what I mentioned last week, that there's been some excerpts from it already out. The report on Randy Duke Cunningham that the House Intelligence Committee's Republican leadership had been sitting on for 4 months, and now we know why. Because it not only tells us that Cunningham, who got a longer prison sentence, 8 years, than any other member of Congress committed for crimes on the job in the history, I think, of the U.S. Not only that he was incredibly corrupt, so much so that he actually had a rate card for how much he would sell his services for, but that there were a number of Republican staffers on the House Intelligence Committee who had all of the red flags that Cunningham was pulling this kind of stuff and chose to look the other way. That probably deserves a lot. It's very reminiscent of Mark Foley, actually, and what House Republican leadership and members and aides already knew about him. Also we should mention as part of that Peter Hoekstra, the Republican chair of that committee, was so angry that this report was leaked that he suspended a Democratic staff member of that committee for the leak, even though there's no evidence whatsoever that he had anything to do with it. And that's become its own little firestorm in Beltway circles. And then we also have in the corrupt Congress parade, FBI agents raiding the home of the lobbyist daughter of Kurt Weldon, a Republican congressman from southeast Pennsylvania. Three days previously, Weldon had been accused of helping his daughter win contracts by essentially getting favors for her clients or guaranteeing them favors. And this is the same Weldon, mind you, who is notorious for hanging out out with associates of former Yugoslav dictator Milosevic. So he's a swell guy. And then finally, in the sleaze of the week, something that was expected, but it's still kind of sad. Kenneth Lay, according to a federal court judge in Houston, his convictions, all 10 of them, have been overturned because he didn't get a chance to appeal because, of course, he had a heart attack. And therefore, his estate will get to keep $44 million that otherwise would have gone to defrauded investors. And that's five entries in Sleaze of the Week, one for every weekday of the week.
All right. Anything in the Abramoff update?
Oh, I mentioned that. That was the Ken Mailman stuff that he's right. now the Republican National Committee chair.
All right. Lynn Stewart.
Yes. For folks who don't remember this story, it's been going on for about 4 years now. She is a radical attorney in New York City who was frequently appointed by the courts there to defend particularly Middle East defendants who were accused of terrorism. And she got in a great deal of trouble. She became basically the first federal test case for violation of attorney-client privilege. She was accused essentially of smuggling messages out of jail for one of her clients to radical Muslims associated with al-Qaeda. She was convicted last year in those charges in a trial that a lot of people questioned. Her sentencing had been held up for a year and a half, in part because she had breast cancer. She's 67 years old. The feds wanted 30 years in prison for her, which basically would have been a death sentence since she wouldn't have gotten out until her 80s or 90s, and has poor health. Well, it turns out this week that she did finally get sentenced, and she got sentenced to exactly 2 years and 4 months in prison, 28 months. This was far less than anybody expected. The judge pointed to a long record of public service and, of course, the fact that she can't reoffend because she can't at this point practice law. She is going to try and appeal that, but it does kind of point up the shakiness of the original case against her, and that once again, even though the charges were relatively flimsy, they have derailed her career and had a significant chilling effect on anybody else who might want to defend these folks. But of course, with habeas corpus, these people now no longer have access to lawyers anyway, so it's kind of moot.
All right. Well, speaking of flimsy charges, briefly, the AP story this week.
AP story on a gentleman named Ali Partovi. And if you've never heard his name, that's because he's incarcerated in Florence, Arizona, a federal corrections facility there. He is the last person who is being held from the post-9/11 sweeps of Muslims in the United States. He's an Iranian who came into the country illegally, served a handful of weeks for that particular charge. One would have thought he would have been either deported or he was seeking asylum. After that, he's had numerous lawsuits alleging torture at the hands of his federal guards and captors. He is still in prison 5 years later without any charges whatsoever. So once again, something's seriously, seriously wrong in our federal justice system.
Moving on to international this week in Iraq.
This was a busy, busy, busy and bloody, bloody week in Iraq. Really, in many ways, a pretty significant cluster of events happening. We'll start with stuff that happened outside Iraq. Major General William Caldwell, the top U.S. military spokesman in Iraq, basically broke with the Bush administration this week and stated pretty clearly that the Baghdad strategy has failed. Presumably this means also that they won't be digging a trench around the city of many millions of people anymore. According to Caldwell, violence in Baghdad has been up 22% in the last 2 weeks. And not only that, but a lot of it has been in areas where U.S. Military presence has been concentrated. So it's not working at all. Meantime, Bush, partially in response to this, and also he made a couple comments the day previous to Caldwell, acknowledges that it's going badly, but what he meant was that it was going badly at home. He even compared it to the Tet Offensive, or said it comparisons could be made to the Tet Offensive, not so much in terms of the military impact, but in terms of the fact that it was discouraging Americans from the war effort. And in fact, last night, once again, he and Rumsfeld both said, we're going to stay the course. We're not going to change our strategy whatsoever. However, there are an increasing number of reports that the Iraq study group that was being run through Congress by old Bush ally James Baker due for recommendations in January, that it is looking for ways to recommend some sort of face-saving exit strategy for the Bush administration. A lot of reports leaking out to that effect, and virtually everyone on all sides of the aisle in Washington are agreeing that the current strategy isn't going to work and that Bush is going to have to do something after the elections. Now, why he would choose to come out before the elections and be, you know, virtually the only person in the country who thinks that the current strategy is productive, why he thinks that's going to help the Republicans on November 7th is anybody's guess. But I think it just kind of shows how divorced from reality they think they are politically. Meantime, in Iraq itself, it was a dreadful week. You've probably heard about all the violence that's happening on in Baghdad, so let me dwell on a couple of things that didn't happen in Baghdad. In a town called Balad, which is north of Baghdad, dozens of people were killed last week. And the reason why this is particularly significant is it's right next to a U.S. military base and Camp Anaconda, and that base routinely every day patrols the town of Balad. However, they mysteriously disappeared right before the death squads appeared for 2 days of massacres. And so Iraqis across the country are asking, why is the United States disappearing? And this question has been asked before. Why is the U.S. military disappearing right when the death squads and all the violence shows up and then not coming back in until afterwards? The U.S., of course, is saying, well, we want Iraqi troops to take the lead in quelling sectarian violence. The problem with that is that the Iraqi army is riddled with people who are also affiliated with militias that are perpetrating much of this violence, so they're hardly in a position where they're going to stop it. In fact, they may be perpetrating it themselves. Meanwhile, in southern Iraq, in the city of where are we here? This is a long list. I hate to say there it is. The city of Amara. That was the city that was abandoned by the British, who had a base there. In August, they left for a sense obscure mission of patrolling the border with Iran. The Mahdi army of Muqtada al-Sadr was the dominant force there. Ferocious battle breaking out there in the last couple of days between the Mahdi army and other Shia sects. What we're starting to see, particularly in the south of Iraq, is not only Shiite versus Sunni violence, but also different Shia groups that are battling each other. Also not being widely reported is that we're on the verge of civil war between Sunni police and military forces in the north of the country and the Kurdish Peshmerga. In other words, it's all going to Hades in a hell basket there, and there's bloody little that the U.S. military presence is doing to prevent any of it. A peace and reconciliation conference scheduled by the Iraqi government that was supposed to be held in Baghdad today was canceled this week by the government. Prime Minister al-Maliki also this week instructed the health ministry to stop giving the United Nations civilian death toll counts. Those counts have been historically badly undercounted, but they were somewhat consistent from month to month, so they were an indicator of the relative level of violence. The government doesn't want you to know anymore, taking a page undoubtedly from the U.S. Embassy's recommendations. Meantime, there's a report from the Ministry of Education in Iraq that only 30% of Iraq school children are attending classes this year. That down from a nearly 100% attendance rating in spring 2003, immediately after the U.S. invasion and occupation. The reason, of course, being the widespread violence and the fear of families that their children will be targeted, particularly since death squads have been attacking schools. One piece of very good news, Riverbend, the blogger who does Baghdad Burning, is back. She was depressed for a couple months, but she did post again this week, which is good to know, because a lot of people had been concerned about her safety. The last thing that I'll mention here is that it was announced that the special tribunal against Saddam Hussein and his top lieutenants, that the verdict and sentence, probably a death sentence, will be handed down on November 5th. Now, if this seems like a vaguely familiar date before, it's the 2 days before and the last U.S. news cycle before the November 7th midterms. What a coincidence, huh? Just kind of a curious coincidence there. So we may have that may be seen by the Bush folks as a November surprise. But again, you know, at this point, not only are people in Iraq and the Middle East considering that that trial, which has basically been run by the U.S. Embassy, has been a farce, but it's such a preordained conclusion that it's hard to see where they would get any kind of real advantage from it, especially when every other headline from Iraq has been going so badly. And since we've now, not only according to the Lancet study, which I haven't even mentioned, of 655,000 dead, which came out this week and was widely accepted much of the rest of the world, except for here in Britain, that vastly outstrips the 300,000 dead attributed to Saddam. But we also had a report from the UN last month that there's more torture going on now than under Saddam. So it, you know, if, makes you wonder if Saddam is getting held accountable for his crimes, when will Bush be held accountable for his? And maybe November 7th will be the start of that process.
All right, so is that it for Iraq?
That's well enough.
All right. Actually got a couple emails from listeners.
I screwed something up.
Asking about, isn't a progressive candidate with significant support being arrested for not having enough dollars to get into a senatorial debate 3 weeks before, 3 weeks before the election, a pretty important local facet to the problem of corporate monopolization of our communications channels? That comes from Linda Jansen.
You know, I didn't get into that for a reason. I do think debates should be open at the same time. And I thought that Bruce Guthrie's appearance as a libertarian, even though he sort of exploited a loophole in the rules to get in, was really valuable because he raised a lot of issues where Cantwell and McGavick obviously don't vary whatsoever. I had trouble seeing the rest as anything other than a publicity stunt, to be honest. That isn't to say that Aaron Dixon shouldn't have been in the debates. I think he should have been. But I don't think the fact that he got arrested in and of itself was newsworthy. And I'll leave it at that.
All right. Talking with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat the State. And I know you guys are at the beginning of a fun drive of your own.
Yeah,
at the end of the KXP one. But.
Yeah, we're in the midst of our 10th anniversary, and we haven't had a fun drive all year because, frankly, we've had a lot of really generous donations and support from advertisers and things like that. But it has come to the point where we're now scraping the bottom of our shoebox once again and trying to raise money to keep putting Eat the State out. So if you can help out, please do. We always need donations to keep the publication going. It's totally volunteer. There's no paid staff. There's no staffed office, anything like that. All the writers, you know, volunteer, and you know, most of the rest of the publication is all volunteer too. In terms of, we pay a little stipend to our layout guy who does it professionally, but that's about it. The rest of it all goes to printing and postage. So if you can help out, that would be great. We always take all kinds of other volunteers, of course, too. We particularly need distributors at this point for several routes, downtown and Capitol Hill being the two most pressing, but you know, Queen Anne would be nice, and Beacon Hill, I think, is still open, and a couple other places. And you can, for inquiries into any of that, you can leave a message on our voicemail. It's area code 206-719-6947. If you're interested in donating online or want to see the publication online or see any of our back issues or any of that kind of stuff, the website is www.eatthestate.org. And if you want to pick up the print publication, it's available at fine places where free publications are picked up, read, and left on the table or thrown away or taken home. At bookstores and cafes, the King County Library System, all kinds of places like that. And again, that phone number, if you want to call and help out, is area code 206-719-6947.
And you guys are going to start your election issue coverage next week?
Yeah. The issue that's coming out this coming Thursday, we'll have election endorsements, and then we'll talk about that on the air here next week as well. And then the current issue, there's a story that I did on my exit from Seattle Weekly, and that publication sort of meltdown in terms of the news department and a lot of the rest of its content that's getting a lot of play in local media and national local media journalism circles. So might be of interest to folks who are wondering what the heck has happened to that publication.